Hello and welcome to the Max Moo podcast. This is Lindsay Behrens, the founder of Max Moo, a website, email newsletter, and podcast about New York City theater, mostly theater beyond Broadway. I wanted to start today by saying thank you to everyone who has reached out to Max Moo on Twitter and Facebook. We love hearing from you. We love hearing that you love the podcast. We love hearing that you think we're too mean to old people when we tease them about having so much power in the theater audience. We love hearing when you agree with us about shows. We love hearing when you disagree with us about shows. We love hearing from out-of-towners who listen to the podcast to stay up to date on New York City theater. And more than anything, we love it when you bring our attention to shows that we haven't previously heard about. So please follow Max Moo on Twitter. It's at M-A-X-A-M-O-O. And let us know what you're seeing, what you love, what you hate, and what you recommend. Today's episode is a roundtable discussion about the shows we've seen and what we're looking forward to seeing in New York City theater. Enjoy the show. So let's do the introductions. Nicole.
Hi, this is Nicole from Mildly Bitter's Musings.
Hey, this is David Levy from fuckyeahstevensondheim.tumblr.com and other places on the internet.
And this is Lindsay, the founder of Max Moo. So, David, you produced a show last night called Three Wishes for Sondheimmas, which is a celebration of Stephen Sondheim's birthday.
That's correct.
Were you happy with it?
Oh, my God. It was so incredible. We had a very full house of 54 below. I don't want to say sellout because I haven't heard the actual numbers, but like very close.
Packed.
Dana Delaney was in the audience, which thank God I didn't know until after the show was over because like, oh, my God, she was on China Beach. And it was a lot of fun. And like, there's nothing more thrilling than seeing an audience appreciate something that you've put together. And like, I knew my friends were going to like it and I'm grateful that they did, but I've been getting emails and Facebook messages from strangers who like paid a lot of money to see my show and are already asking about next year. And oh my God. And like, I write about theater and I talk about theater, but this is the first like cabaret/theater piece that I've done since college, which was a lot of years ago. So it was very gratifying. I was so lucky to have a team of incredibly dedicated and professional people bringing this to life.
That's awesome. We had a great time. I thought it was tons of fun.
Thanks for coming. What did you order?
Food-wise?
Yeah. Do you have a cookie plate?
No, you know what I ordered? I ordered that apple crisp thing that you ordered that I said looked good that time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We both got that. It was yummy.
It was good.
The important thing. What did you eat?
Look.
What did you eat at the celebration of Sondheim?
So the truth is, when I started going to 54 Below, I started a 54 Below food diary on my phone where I kept track of what I ate and what I drank and what I thought about them because I thought I was going to do a column for the Craptacular about dining out at New York's cabarets.
What I like to call dinner theater.
Which, you know, still may come to pass someday. Like, for example, I heard that Joe's Pub has discontinued the pizza popcorn, which was everybody's favorite, which is like a big scandal in the cabaret world.
There's so little I can eat at the Joe's Pub menu that this is why I end up with the soft serve. Because everything has like onions in it. Everything, like there's just like an ingredient in almost all of the dishes that I can't eat.
The soft serve is delicious, but no one needs to pay $15 for soft serve.
Right. And that's the thing. Like, and then I go two nights in a row and I'm like, soft serve again. It starts to lose its appeal.
I think the food is so much better at Joe's Pub than 54's Below.
The short ribs at 54 Below are really tasty.
I've never had that.
It depends on what you like, you know?
I don't know. I don't think the food there is very good. But sorry.
You're allowed. You're allowed to have wrong opinions.
I just want to say.
This is all getting cut.
This is all in. I interviewed Kirkland from the Fruit Mechanics earlier this week. And it was so cool.
I'm so excited.
I can't wait
to
hear it.
I'm so jealous I couldn't be there.
He is amazing. They are amazing. I kind of also hate him. I will say.
Is that like I hate him because he's so talented?
No, no.
Like he's a life ruiner?
This is like the second interview I've done. It only took two interviews for me to say, mid-interview, I think I kind of hate you.
Which shows a lot of restraint on your part.
You're the worst person, I think is actually what I said.
I can't wait to hear how he earned that.
I think that everyone will agree with me.
Turns out he's a secret Nazi.
No, he's like the nicest person.
Right. This is more a reflection on you than on Kirkland.
Yeah, this is 100% a reflection on me than it is on him. He's awesome. That will be out on Thursday. I hope everyone will listen to it because they're just fucking awesome. And I want to go to Austin in August.
No one wants to go to Austin in August.
No, I take that back. In September.
Much better.
Yeah. I would like to say I did receive an email immediately following the interview that said we have to go to Austin in September. Also, somebody did not arrange my future marriage to Thomas Graves.
I did arrange for you to go to Austin to meet him. You have to have a first date before you get a marriage proposal.
Fuck. This is really complicated.
Today's drinking game is to drink every time one of us says fuck on the podcast. If you're keeping track, that's everyone. Two. Yeah. Three if you count my instructions.
Okay, let's talk about shows. Nicole, why don't you start?
Okay, what am I talking about? I saw King Lear yesterday at Theater for a New Audience. And I'd like to say that someone almost died while we were there in the
literally,
audience.
Yeah.
Actually, there was a person who went into some sort of medical situation. There were chest compressions. Super awkward because the actors didn't know and they kept going. And like the whole audience is tittering. And I was up by the booth where the director is because it's still in previews. And, you know, like stage managers, everyone's talking and there's stuff happening. So like no one in the audience anymore is paying attention to what's happening to the poor actors. And then finally someone's like, can you guys stop? We need to stop this right now.
Like someone in the audience?
No, I think actually the director came out and told the actors to stop. One of the other actors shouted for like a doctor. And I mean, the EMTs eventually came in and took this person away, and I believe he was okay. But it's definitely one of those moments where it's an entire play about mortality, and like having that sort of set you off at the beginning is like, oh my God. So a little distracting also from the work at hand. But, you know, I've talked about Lear before. It's not my favorite, that's for sure.
And yet, how many Lears are you seeing this year?
I'm scheduled to see... Well, I mean, Shakespeare in the Park, I already have a ticket because I'm a young partner. So against my will, that's, you know, I think I'm probably up to three, maybe. if I maybe see the NT Live one with Simon Russell Beale.
No, so that'd be four, right?
No, I didn't see the Frank Langella.
Oh, you skipped it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, I'm so proud of you.
Because I hate Frank Langella. I hate Frank Langella and King Lear. Like,
keep in mind,
Nicole's... I hate King Lear, so I'm only seeing it three times in one calendar year.
Keep in mind, Nicole's never seen Frank Langella on stage.
Like, yeah, let's all be clear about my completely irrational hatred of Frank Langella. Yeah. Because he reminds me of my stepfather.
Okay, but let's see.
Theater therapy.
Oh, wow.
If you like Lear, it's a very good production.
Oh, okay.
And unfortunately, also due to the audience emergency and the necessity of getting to 54 below for the evening, the third show of my day, I ended up having to leave at intermission because I didn't want to be that person who tries to like run out of a show midway through the second act. And especially with the configuration of Theater for a New Audience, where the actors are entering and exiting on the same space where patrons would walk. I did not want to be that jackass. So I sat outside the theater during the second act, listened over the you know, they have sort of little audio things happening outside, and tried to listen to as much as I could before I had to run uptown.
That's commitment.
So I do apologize to Theater for a New Audience for missing Act Two. It was not a reflection on the work. It was a reflection on my poor scheduling sense and that person's heart attack. So things that could not be helped.
Hey, while we're talking about Theater for a New Audience, did you guys hear that apparently the Julie Taymor Midsummer that they opened their new space with has been filmed, so people like me who regrettably missed that production are going to get a chance to experience it. I'm very excited about this news.
All right, David.
I guess let me talk about a play that I saw a couple weeks ago called Sex Tips for Straight Women from a Gay Man. Now, this is not a show that I would have probably seen had I not been offered press seats, but I will say this. It was really kind of a fun evening. It stars Jason Michael Snow, who was one of the original cast members of Book of Mormon and who has a very hilarious internet presence both on Twitter and on YouTube. He writes, he also writes musicals, and he writes parody musicals that you can find on YouTube that are really great. And Lindsay Nicole Chambers, who we love from Submissions Only, where she plays the assistant secretary person. And I should know the character name because I've been watching it forever and I'm a Kickstarter backer, but
I know, me too. I'm like, wait, all of a sudden, like the name, like, I just watched episode two as well. So, we know this.
No, we're not going to come up with it. It's okay. We love her.
Gail,
thank you. This is apparently based on a real book with that title that apparently was featured prominently in the Meryl Streep movie, Hope Springs, which I have not seen.
Because who saw that movie?
I don't know. I think my parents saw it.
I mean, it wasn't it about like Tommy Lee Jones and Meryl Streep not having sex anymore in their marriage?
And right, and then she reads this book and has sex with young people, I think. I don't know. But anyway, the show Lizzie just made a face.
There was
I think,
a reaction.
Which
there.
I think was the face of like, ew, Meryl Streep having sex with young people.
No. Meryl Streep can have sex with anyone she wants.
How very empowering of you. Anyway.
This is a pro-sex podcast.
That's true. So this show falls into, I think, a subgenre that I would like to dub Bachelorette Party Theater. Right? There's nods around the table. Which is admittedly not a genre that I am naturally inclined towards, but
I've never been to a bachelorette party in New York City, so but I know that they happen and exist.
But like Naked Boys Singing is that kind of a show.
But like I would never. And, but I'm saying I've never had the I've never actually had the motivation to go to one of those things because it's never happened here.
Right. So it's, you know, it's rowdy. They serve drinks. I recommend drinking. There's
do
some
you get penis straws with your drink.
No, but there is some audience participation. There is a moment when everyone is taught how to give a hand job, and then we're all invited to demonstrate. And then a couple lucky audience members, including yours truly, have to like stand up and demonstrate.
There's some gag reflex happening on one of the microphones.
People get called onto the stage. It's look, it is not going to radically alter your worldview unless you're incredibly sheltered. But it's like a winning cast. The third member of the cast is Andrew Bremer, who basically exists to be hot and often scantily clad. And it's nice to see the men being the ones objectified for once. And it's just, you know, if you're looking for the kind of like turn your brain off and have a good time with a drink and some friends, like it's great for that. And it's right in Times Square. So, you know, it's easy to find, and yeah, I would recommend it. I mean, you know, for that kind
right,
of thing.
In that kind of, yeah.
I really believe that, like, theater can be judged on its own ambitions, and, like, you don't judge this in the same way that you judge King Lear, and we're going to come back to that.
There are a lot less sex tips in King Lear.
Right.
And it's the poorer work for it.
And I'm going to come back to that principle when we talk about another show that I saw last week.
Although I do want to, if we're going to be talking about sex tips and objectification, I do need to mention, I feel like last week I left this out and I don't know how I did when we were talking, I was talking about Bridges, which is, you know, a show that the best part about it is certainly the singing that, you know, and the sex. But Kelly O'Hara, banging body right now. She just had a baby in September. I mean, looks fantastic for anyone who needs to know this piece of information. If you can't convince your husband to go with you to see this show and you're going to weep the entire time, let him know. I saw her boobs. She looks great. Anyway, for the record.
Thanks, Seth MacFarlane.
I objectified Steve Pasquale all last week's episode. I feel like everybody needs to know, you know, equal opportunity.
Well, since we're clarifying last week's episode, I would like to add that on last week's episode, when I said Stephen Pasquale was sexy, I wasn't adopting like a heteronormative persona. I was expressing that from a queer perspective.
Right.
Stephen Pasquale would make a damn sexy lesbian.
That is correct.
I think he fits into that category that, like, I think we've talked about this in the past, that for a generation before mine, it was David Bowie. And like when I was growing up, it was Michael Stipe. But there are certain people who just sort of transcend gender and sexuality in the kind of sexiness they exude. If you only know Michael Stipe as he is today, that's probably like a totally befuddling thing to say. But like when I was in high school and Automatic for the People came out, and he like got out of that car and walked down the highway, like, oh.
And there was no one else like him then.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. You know.
And there is no one else like Stephen Pasquale. Yeah.
He's got a lot of floppy hair going on. Looks very lesbionic. I love it.
Lindsay, what do you see this week?
Well, I saw a few things. I guess I'll talk about first a show called Fast Company that is at Ensemble Studio Theater that was first mentioned on the podcast by Mike Liu during our Looking Harder for More Diverse Theater episodes. It's written by Carla Ching, and it's a kind of a caper, a play about a caper. Like, you have these group of con artists and they're sort of mid heist and something goes awry, and then there's lots of twists of fortune and surprises in the show. It's very fast paced and funny and excellent act. I thought the actors were all excellent. If you like things like the TV show Leverage or the movie Ocean's 11. I think this would be right up your alley.
Great Muppet Caper.
That also.
Oh, Charles Grodin. I had such a crush on him.
What?
That was a great Muppet Caper reference. It also starred Diana Rigg, you know, who is British, and so therefore Nicole.
I had less of a crush on her.
Fast Company is very good. Like I said, it's funny, and there are twists, and so you're surprised, and yeah, some things you see coming, but some things you don't, and
also true of Sex Tips.
And also true of sex. Anyway, that was really fun. It's on my recommendation list. All right, let's talk about why don't you talk about Realistic Joneses?
I know a lot of Joneses.
That's the Will Eno play.
Yep. Yes. So this is Will Eno's first play on Broadway. Directed
well
by
done,
Sam
Will Eno.
Gold. I know
you made it.
We all know that is not the road we expect of all playwrights all
no,
the time.
But I have to assume that he's being paid more for this than he probably has been paid for things that have appeared in smaller theaters.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, and I was a little surprised, frankly, to hear that a Will Eno play was going to Broadway, because his sensibility is incredibly oddball. And
what is his relationship to Brian Eno?
That is a good question.
Because I relate them in my head, because they're both sort of in that, like, they're quirky kind of space.
And their last name is Eno?
Yes.
Are we certain there's no connection?
I have no idea. I just made that up. I have no idea.
Listeners, do your work.
Tweet to
Let
us
know.
All right, so we saw the show.
And it's essentially about two couples who are neighbors and how they sort of become intertwined in each other's lives. And it stars Toni Collette and Tracy Letts as one couple, and Marissa Tomei and Michael C. Hall is the other couple. Shocking. Michael C. Hall got entrance applause.
Oh, it
WTF
was
WTF Broadway.
He's been on TV, right?
Yes.
He was I saw him in Cabaret a million years ago, but like.
Right. No, and I know he has.
There was bad audience behavior at this show.
I mean, I was actually a little surprised that he was the one of all. Like, I guess.
What happened was basically you had one woman sitting in the audience who was clearly there solely for the purpose of seeing him. Ooh. And so it starts. He's not on stage when it starts, and he comes on stage at a later moment. And she's sitting off to our right. We're in the. In the orchestra. And I don't think there would have been audience applause, except for this woman goes, and then it just like sets off all this applause. And I was like, holy shit.
But you know what? That's all it takes. Like at Aladdin, there's been standing ovations after a friend like me, which I'll talk about later. But that's the kind of thing where it only takes like one or two people to stand up for that like kind of peer pressure thing to explode over the audience.
Why do we have that? Anyway,
please continue.
So it's very early in preview, so I feel like I really need to preface with that, because I think I'd like to go back and see this again later in the run. Because I think like Will Eno has a very specific meter to his comedy. It's very smart. It's very droll. But there's a lot of these really wonderful push-pull contradictions. I feel like every character sets something up and deconstructs it mid-sentence. Like, in a way, you know, in a very Daniel Kitson way. Like, in the way in which language is played with and pushed and bent in really fun, smart, and interesting directions. And that's very, very funny. But you have to deliver it right. And I think... I mean, Tracy Letts, no question. Oh, fantastic.
So good.
I mean, we love him. We love him drawing hearts all over.
It's just not fair that one person gets so much talent.
He's really fantastic. And he's fantastic in this. I think the rest of the cast needs some time to get into the rhythm of the work. And I hope that they'll nail it later. Because they're not necessarily people... I mean, they all have stage credits. And, you know, none of these are, you know, complete neophytes to theater. But they're not people I immediately associate with comedic timing.
Although, wasn't Toni Collette's show on Showtime ostensibly a comedy?
Was it? I never saw it.
The United States of Tara. One. She,
Oh, and let's not forget Connie and Carla, which is my favorite feature-length motion picture about dinner theater ever.
I mean,
also a caper.
And Muriel's Wedding, which is great. But actually... I didn't think that any of the cast was bad. There could just, it could just be better. And it's the kind of better that I think you see actors get over time in a role like, in roles like those. And so I would expect that that comic timing and learning to read the audience reaction, because there was a lot of, you know, the audience would laugh and they were still, they were saying their line. And it's just kind of thing where it's like, just slow down and wait for the audience, the laughter to roll through the audience. And I'm sure that's the kind of thing that's, I'm not discounting the challenge of that, because every audience is different. So some nights you get a laugh in one place that's extended and you're just not anticipating it. And so that's the kind of thing that I would imagine that over time, when you do more and more performances, improves.
So let me ask you this. Why are you seeing shows in previews if we know that it takes time for them to get into this rhythm and the show's going to be better later? And...
Well, I definitely don't have time to see it in April. That's why.
Because when I first moved here, I was seeing shows and previews all the time, and I kept realizing that I wasn't enjoying them as much as my friends. And when I thought about why, it was because my friends were seeing them after they opened.
Well, I mean, I don't think, there's a false positive in that, because you can start to read press about something and then like it more because the world has told you you'll like it more.
But even if I see it late, like, you know, right before opening as opposed to early previews.
Yeah, no, and I don't encourage early previews generally. Like, I try to catch the previews the weekend before opening. It's mm-hmm. usually what I'm targeting.
That's my ideal time to see a show.
Right. Like, I'm going to see Cabaret the night before opening.
Yeah, which... and I think I was scrambling to see this because I can't see it in April. And, you know, this was like the one time I had a slot on Friday and I was like, shoot, what can I squeeze in there?
And yet, I would like to read back from the record. I'm going to go back and see this again.
I mean, if it runs,
yeah, you'd like to. You'd like
if
to.
It runs, right. Yeah. Then yeah.
Well, here's the thing I think is interesting is that we paid about $100 for our seats.
For a play with four people?
We had discounted. We had good seats in the orchestra. We used a discount code. And that's too much to pay for this show, in my opinion. If I'd paid $50 for this show, I think I would have been like, everybody should go see this show.
I mean, oh, so
but
actually,
I would hesitate to say you should pay $100 or more to see this show.
Like, and I saw Mothers and Sons in previews. I totally forgot that I saw that show this month until we started this discussion. But I paid like $35 for, you know, for a balcony seat. But still, and right. even then, I was like,
the problem,
it's a tiny theater.
The problem with the balcony seats is that you are so far away that for a straight play, you are missing a substantial amount of the acting.
Not when Tyne Daly's in the middle.
Well, okay. So, I mean, perhaps there are plays where it works. But, like, for example, I saw Orphans.
Yep.
I paid $35 for that seat in the back row of the balcony. And I was fine. I thought it was... I know people that... Well, that production had a lot of issues, but... I actually was like, yeah, for $35, I really enjoyed this show. I wish I could have seen more of the acting and sat closer to it. But you can't have it both ways in a huge right. house like that. And this show, to me, is a perfect example of like a production I really enjoyed, even if I think it could improve. As is, I really enjoyed it. I'm glad I saw it. I think I would recommend it to people. But that is a price point that, to me, exceeds the output of the production.
I also, like... I don't know. I'm a little worried about this production because I think it's like you think it's much more accessible than I do.
I did think it was pretty accessible. It didn't seem to me because you had talked about Will Eno and how he's quirky, but this did not strike. A lot of the laugh lines are really obvious, and the way they're acted, they're like really like, you know, they're feeding you the humor. So.
I think which is also I think part of the problem. Like, I don't think the actors know what they're doing with the material yet.
Perhaps not.
I would say I think there's accessible and there's accessible. I'm thinking of like the movie Blue Jasmine, where you can enjoy that film on a certain level, whether or not you understand the ways in which it is recalling and commenting on Tennessee Williams.
Sure.
But if you do understand that, you'll enjoy it on a different level. And I think from what I understand about Realistic Joneses, it's also one of those sort
I
of...
I think the broader humor level of it that people might be reacting to, I don't know. I just feel like you'd walk out of it and you're going to be like, well, that wasn't God of Carnage, but, you know, but I think there's...
But what is?
But, well, I think there's a certain, you know, if you think it's that broad humor, you might come out feeling a little disappointed. It's, you know, because you could interpret it that way, that, oh, it's sort of like, oh, it's wacky neighbors and crazy hijinks, and but it's not about that at all.
At all?
At all.
Well, it's about...
Perhaps I didn't fully capture
not
the
having
of the
seen
show.
The play at all. From what I understand, that it is about our relationship as consumers of art about wacky neighbors and neighborhood hijinks, kind of.
That's like, what you think the play's about?
That it's some kind of a commentary, much like that play at the Signature that you all saw that I didn't get to see.
Oh, the open house.
No, the holy fucking shit one. Drink.
Oh, appropriate.
Appropriate.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, that it's on one level, it's like a story about something. And on another level, it's a commentary on like the American dramatic tradition of telling those kinds of stories.
Sure.
Right. I don't know. Maybe we need to have a deeper discussion about the meaning of that show, because it's totally possible that I was appreciating it on one level and half of another level and not on the deeper level that you were.
Maybe you're just not smart enough, Lindsay.
It's totally possible. Nicole and I did go see a show at the Edinburgh Fringe, and in my defense, it was really fucking hot in that theater. And when I am overheated, my brain just shuts down.
That's a good segue into
and
the next show.
I was really, I watched the show, I enjoyed it, and we walked out afterwards. And Nicole said something like, "Oh, I didn't realize it when it turned out that the child was also the bad guy in the show." And I just looked at her like, "What are you talking about?
What show is that?"
The Lemon Squeezy Show.
Don't worry, Easy listeners. I have no idea what they're talking about either. I just want to point out that Lindsay right now is wearing a Los Angeles Fringe 2011 shirt.
No, it's Edinburgh.
And,
Edinburgh.
Oh, sorry, Edinburgh. And she's also drinking out of an Edinburgh Fringe 2011 mug that matches her shirt.
I'm drinking out of a mug that matches my t-shirt.
That's hilarious.
Just to be clear, this mug and this t-shirt are not from the Edinburgh Fringe that I'm referencing. These are from an earlier festival.
I like also that you're still talking about a show, and I'm like, wait, which show are we talking about?
Easy Peasy Lemon Squeezy. Come on.
That's the line from it. It's the painters, and they forge the paintings.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, okay.
Anyway, we've talked about this for way too long. Whoa, okay. David, Father Comes Home from the Wars, parts 1, 2, and 3.
All right. So first of all, I love the public theater, but... oh my God, was that theater too hot?
Way too hot.
And I saw it on a Sunday night at the end of a busy weekend, and I struggled to keep my eyes open, especially during parts 1 and 2, which are very talky and very static.
So it's really a 3-part play?
It is a 9-part play, and we're seeing the first 3 parts
Whoa!
Of it. Or it is 9 short 1-act plays, and we are seeing the first trilogy of a trilogy of trilogies.
Okay.
Because apparently Susan Laurie Parks is the George Lucas of Civil War slave narratives.
Now, are all 9
public
parts...
theater, you can put that on a poster.
Are all 9 parts about the Civil War?
I don't know. I know that when they did a previous lab production of this, they did parts 1, 2, and 8.
Right.
So we could probably find out. And I think it's worth saying the public lab is their workshop series.
Yeah.
When I saw it, Susan Laurie Parks introduced the show and said that, you know, it's changing every day. Some of the actors may come out with script pages, although none of them did. Really framed it that way, which I thought was helpful because I'd only seen one previous show at the lab, which was Venice, which was probably the worst thing I saw last year.
It was not good.
But was not framed that way.
Right.
Anyway.
You didn't see the lab of Fun Home?
No. I didn't live here
that
yet.
That was so wonderful.
Also, lab shows are like $15.
Yes.
So,
for
but they sell
15
really
for members, 20 for non-members, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I would just like
to give Susan Laurie Parks a note on her opening speech, which is, don't tell people to turn their phones on vibrate.
Yeah, no kidding.
That is not a helpful setting in a theater. I was pissed.
Still
oh, there
loud.
Was a woman. There was a woman 2 rows in front of me with a watch that beeped like it was 1994. I don't know where she got that watch. I don't know why it was beeping, but it beeped, and she didn't shut it off. It just beeped and beeped and beeped and
shut
beeped.
Shut up!
Oh my God! I didn't.
Oh, that's
also Susan Laurie Parks didn't introduce herself, so like I knew who she was because like I have a little bit of a talent crush on her. But I'm sure half the people in the room were like, "Who's this lady talking to us?"
She must have gotten that note because of the show I saw, which is after you saw it, she introduced herself.
That's funny.
All right, so let's talk about the show.
Okay, so it is a trilogy of trilogies. And this was the first trilogy. The weird thing about this show is that the first 2 parts, which were before the intermission, were these very static, talky, I would call them like modernist realistic theater, where like people sit on the front stoop of a slave shack and talk about slavery. And it had a lot of really interesting ideas, but just the first one was on the shack, and the second one was out at a camp on the road of war. But it's just there was so little happening. It was really it felt like someone reading an essay to me. And then the third part, after the intermission, was like a totally different universe of theater where there's suddenly like a talking dog in Greek tragedy. And for me, as someone who likes Susan Laurie Parks because she does experimental stuff, I was like, oh, yes, this is what I was looking for. But it didn't it was so out of left field after 2 hours of talk. Like, I didn't know what to do with it. And then there was one moment about two-thirds of the way through that act where the father who came home from the war made sort of a shocking revelation, and his wife that he had left behind just sort of was like, yeah, okay, which totally lost everyone in the audience. The whole audience, at the performance I went, they actually started like talking back to the stage. They're like, no way. Like, it was, wow. it was a thing.
That didn't happen at the performance I saw, so maybe there had been some revisions.
It's also possible. I was sitting in a section surrounded by people who I think are studying playwriting at the Public or somehow connected to the institution and or Susan Laurie Parks. So I think that they also, like, there was like a lot of camaraderie going on, and therefore also like a lot of like
feeding off of each other. Yeah.
Well, I just sat here during the entire time David was talking and shaking my head in agreement. The talking dog comes out, and the audience just...
Is it a person?
It's a person, yes. But it's like a person wearing a really
wearing
ugly dog
a
costume.
Bath mat, essentially.
Wait, is it the same bath mat from the Public's production of King Lear that Kelly O'Hara had to wear?
I don't know. It's possible it could have been repurposed. It's a light gray.
Was it pink? Oh.
I mean,
maybe they bleached it.
And the audience just loses their shit. And the funny thing is, oh my God, that dog's so cute. He's so funny. All of a sudden, there's all this humor in a show that's had very little humor.
And the first act is there's this whole long thing about the dog ran away and blah, blah, blah. So when the dog arrived, like,
so
there's
like
been a lot
Sheba
of build up to the dog.
Come
yeah.
back and
that's
all of
exactly what it's like. And the dog's getting applause.
She gets her own
lines
show.
Right and left. And I'm like, what is going
and
on?
And the dog's name is Odyssey. And the dog comes back from having this big, long travel in a play called Father Comes Home from the War, where the father, by the way, is named Ulysses. And all of a sudden, you're like, oh, wait. And his wife is Penny, which is kind of like Penelope. Yeah. And like, and the other character's name is Homer. And you're like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
On the nose.
A little bit.
Yeah, but, and not just in the connection potentially to the Odyssey, but also I thought there was a lot of like saying kind of directly like the choices that confronted slaves during the pre-civil and during the Civil War were hard, and you're like, that is true. I didn't feel like I was really
there was one
learning a lot in the sense that it was
really
giving me a perspective
story
that
a different place.
Wasn't something I hadn't thought about before.
In part two, there was a really great exchange between the slave who had been conscripted into war by his master and a prisoner from the Union Army who was fighting with the Negro Division, who this slave was then like put in charge of holding hostage. So they were in, so it was a slave who was now in the role of captor to a free man who is now once again like enslaved. And the slave made this speech about sort of his anxieties around freedom, which, you know, it's not the first time I've ever heard those arguments, but it was, to me, it was like the one time during the first half of the show that it really came alive. Like it didn't feel like an essay lecturing at me. It actually felt like a fascinating glimpse into a perspective that I don't have and that we don't ever see portrayed.
Yes, but I'd agree. That was a nice moment.
But those moments were a little bit few and far between.
In a production that's over 3 hours long.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else people want to discuss?
I got another show I want to talk about. If we're gonna dip back into Broadway, I saw Aladdin.
Yeah, I want you to talk about Aladdin because no one else is gonna see that here.
So here's the thing. I've been saying since the minute they announced Aladdin that Aladdin is my Newsies. Aladdin is the show that in high school I was obsessed with. I saw the movie 7 times in the movie theater. I had 2 full-size movie posters in my bedroom. I had 2. I had...
Just verifying for the record. 2.
I had an Aladdin costume homemade for me by my mom. I had a lamp. I had a monkey. Like, the whole thing.
I had a monkey.
So it was with great trepidation that I went to see the show, which had three previous productions out of town that were not well received. And I'm relieved to say, like, look, this is not changing the face of Broadway musicals.
This is Disney.
It is Disney. But it's Disney doing Disney well, which was not what I was prepared for. I was prepared for it to be like a disaster like Little Mermaid, which is really one of the worst shows I've seen on Broadway. And instead, it was actually just like a really delightful old-fashioned musical comedy. I would put it on par with Beauty and the Beast, except maybe half a step below, because the new music for Aladdin isn't as good as the new music was for Beauty and the Beast. But James Monroe Iglehart, who you might remember from Memphis, but don't hold that against him, plays the genie and just walks away with this show. I can't imagine anyone could rival him for the best featured actor Tony Award, although there are plenty of performances I haven't seen yet. But I mean, just he carries this multi-million-dollar production on his back. He, Friend Like Me, which was the number that everyone was like, how are they going to do that? It was such a showstopper in the movie for Robin Williams, but relied on so much, you know, of what animation can do. He takes it in a totally different direction. They pull out all the stops of showmanship and kick lines and magic and stuff with costumes and stuff with sets. And it just is the kind of showstopper that comes around like once every 20 years. This is like, you know, opening night of 42nd Street when people saw Gower Champions wearing the money for the first time and just like shat themselves. That's how Friend Like Me is going over. If you don't like Disney, if you don't like Aladdin, this isn't going to change your mind. But if you're looking for, you know, sort of a tired businessman kind of show, like I just want to go be entertained and turn my brain off, it is fun. It is colorful. It's beautiful costumes. And I'm like really like relieved and pleasantly surprised that like this is a show I can totally get behind.
I'm glad to hear that, because I think it's time for there to be another kid friendly show on Broadway. And so
is that sarcasm? Because
no,
there's like a million of them.
Sorry, I wasn't. I think that the Lion, like people are just still going to the Lion King over and over and over again, and people come from out of town and they just go and see it over and over again.
Have you seen the Lion King though? Because
I have. I'm not saying it's a bad show. I'm just saying like. Let's go see something else, even if it's just another Disney show.
I mean,
it's kind of nice.
Because in case you don't want to see Cinderella or Matilda or Newsies.
Well, it doesn't sound to me like, I mean, I haven't seen those shows, but it doesn't sound to me like Cinderella's that great. Matilda doesn't sound to me like it's actually all that friendly a kid's show. I would definitely recommend Newsies. I have seen that. I love it. I also love the movie. So I'm just saying, like, it's nice. I'm trying to be supportive of your stupid Disney musical. You know what? Fuck it. Don't see it.
No, I think it does fit a nice niche in that, and I hate that this is about to come out of my mouth, but like if we can be gender normative for a moment, like Newsies is very much like a boy show, and Cinderella certainly is very much a girl show, and Matilda is kind of a girl show, I don't think that's actually true, but in the way that they're marketed, and the way that people perceive them, and Aladdin like. Which was Disney's intention when they made the movie too, like really hits a nice sweet spot in the middle where like, yeah, there's a princess, but she's not terrible. But it's also like, has a boy at the center and highlights actually male friendship in nice ways that also Newsies does, but is rare. I like Aladdin. There, I said it.
You're on record.
On the record.
Okay, Nicole, why don't you talk about Three Penny Opera at Atlantic Theater?
Sure. So this is the first time I'm seeing the Brecht and Weill Three Penny Opera, adapted in English by Mark Blitstein, who also did Cradle of Rock, which we happened to catch that, or we, me, I happened to catch
I
that
saw it.
Summer.
And me.
Yep.
We sat right in front of each other.
Oh, right. Last summer at Encores for the summer off-Broadway series. And so I was really looking forward to this because I thought the like sort of tenor of it would be sort of right up my alley. Like a little dark, a little satirical, a little edgy. And the production is very gray, both visually and emotionally. And it's a mess.
The gray's not in a good way.
It's not gray in a good way. It's no one has a perspective. Like, there's no point of view to the production. Mm. No one understands it to be... No one understands what they're poking fun of. Oh. No one knows that there's any comedy in it, weirdly. The only... I mean... Rick Holmes actually knows that he is in a comic role and he is playing it for every comic ounce he can get out of it. He's Tiger Brown and he's fantastic. So, you know, there are moments. But I think one of the most successful sequences is when they're in the brothel and Jenny is doing her big show-stopping number. And I'm putting lots of quotes around that. And what's happening around her are all of these, like, very nude trysts between, like, hookers and Johns. And it had this very punch drunk flavor to it. A lot of interesting movement, very sexual, very sort of lurid and whatnot. And I was like, this is, I mean, it's working in this scene, but this is one moment in a much longer show. And I guess Martha Clark's background is dance. She comes out of Pilibus and stuff like that. So it suddenly made sense. Like, oh, okay, well, this sequence seems to really be sort of focused on movement and communicating things through movement is really great. But, I mean, it's terrible because, like, Michael Park is great as Mac Fanife. And so there are moments of stuff that are nice, but the production just doesn't work.
That's too bad. People were really anticipating this production in part because the Blitzstein translation hasn't been done in New York since the very successful, very long off-Broadway production in the 50s. The history of the show, for those who don't know, it was obviously a big... It was a big success in Germany, and when it came to America for the first time, it flopped. Like, no one was interested. And it was when they did the new translation with Mark Blitzstein in, I believe, the 50s, that suddenly it was not only a long-running hit, it's credited as sort of being the first moment of off-Broadway crystallizing into a movement that, like, had some legs to it. And, you know, there have been other translations and certainly other New York productions. Roundabout did it sometime in the last decade. So too bad.
I know. I was, you know, it. Yeah.
The good news is this is a show that will get done again over and over and over again, which I mean, I'm saying that as good news.
You know, and that was the thing. Like, it actually felt conceptually really still relevant. And that was, I guess, the reason I brought up Cradle of Rock, you know, I kind of had moments of throwback to that production from last summer because it was like that. Production, which was a concert production, made it feel still very relevant, and the issues of corruption and power and the bankers versus, you know, the not bankers, and in Three Penny Opera there's just, you know, sort of who's really the criminal, the criminals or the bankers, and all this stuff, like, again, which is very much part of our everyday rhetoric these days. So there's a great reason to revive this now and bring up that conversation and renew that conversation with an older piece of work. Like, and that's what I love about good revivals, is when you revive something understanding what it stood for then and also where it fits in today. And so I guess my disappointment is sort of because I started to see the reasons to bring this revival forth now and to have this conversation now, and this show just didn't quite nail it, and that's just disappointing because I think there's real value in this story today.
Okay. Well, while you guys think about what you're looking forward to seeing next week, I'm going to... What?
I was like, next week? I know I'm seeing one show next week.
Okay, well, you have time to think about what the name of that show is. Well, I talk about some of the things that we've already talked about and that are, like, actually finally opening and or closing. So the Steve Chen A Second Chance opens next week.
Not Steve.
Ted. Oh, my God.
Ted Chen.
Ted Chen. Good Lord.
It's like Stephen Sondheim, Ted Chen, together.
Sorry, Ted. Red Velvet, first performance and opening, both next week. They have a very short preview period for that one. The Library, directed by Steven Soderbergh, starring Chloe Moretz, starts performances next week. Kama Sutra, the play I talk about quite a bit with Kirk Lynn, which sounds awesome, starts performances. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff that's closing. So The Pig, or Vaclav Havlov's Hunt for a Pig, closes. Hand to God, The Open House, and Bum Phillips' All-American Opera all close next week. So
Hand to God hasn't extended yet?
It has an extended. I thought it would, but I then learned that actually there's something planned, scheduled to go in that theater almost right after this. So I think maybe it won't be extended.
I wonder if they'll figure out a way to like move it to another location
or something. I know. I said what's on this podcast, I expect it to extend. And then I saw that scheduling wise, that probably won't happen.
What's next on this?
I can't remember what it's called either. Yeah. All right, so what are you guys actually seeing next week that you're excited about? Or it doesn't have to be next week, because you're not going to be on next week, David. So you can go like 2 weeks or 3 weeks into the future.
I mean, the truth is I haven't been buying tickets so far into the future because I've been so wrapped up in my show. Although 2 weeks into the future, I have tickets to both Guys and Dolls in concert at Carnegie Hall and Most Happy Fella in concert at Encores, which you all know is like my favorite thing ever. This week I'm flying down to Delray Beach to see my dad in his community theater, like musical review production that probably has a title that I have no idea what it is, in his retirement community, which I'm so excited to do.
What is your dad going to do in it?
I know that he's been learning a tap combination, which is hilarious because my dad has never danced in his life.
Oh my God. That's so cute.
And, you know, I'm sure he's also in a couple songs and a couple scenes. Like, this is a thing they do every year they put together, and it's just, it's adorable. And I'm sure also like unbearable to watch.
Is your dad a performer himself?
No,
generally?
never. But my dad is definitely where my love of theater comes from. He's been a theater goer his entire life. And he was that guy in college who did the like show tunes radio show on the college radio station became an accountant. So this is a new thing for him just in the last couple of years. He's now on the board of the theater group. And it's like, he said to me over lunch last year, he's like, David, this is the best thing I've ever done in my life. And I was like, what about me? He's like, different.
A different scale.
Yeah.
So sweet.
So I'm really excited for that.
Plus, you're going to go find some warm weather.
Yes.
Nice. Nicole?
Well, I mean, I'm seeing Red Velvet.
What are you seeing then?
I'm seeing that Saturday night.
Fun.
So I've definitely been talking about that for months. So I'm really excited about that. And then the week following, I am following David around town and seeing Guys and Dolls and Most Happy Fellow as well.
Ooh, you guys are doing so much fun stuff. So the only other thing there are two other things I wanted to mention. There's this play called Wild by Crystal Skillman that I've been trying to get to forever. It's she does a lot of work with the Vampire Cowboys. It's a New York City theater company that does a lot of theater that you would I kind of describe as like comic book theater, a lot of martial arts, gameplay, cosplay type things.
I would call it genre theater. Or is it not?
No, but this is the specific genre they do, which is comic books.
Oh.
And she wrote a play called Geek that was very popular. But this is more of a drama. It's called Wild. And so I'm hoping to see that next week. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is this monthly series called The Soundtrack Series. And it's a storytelling event. It's like stories about music. I've never been to it, but I have seen performers do the things that they do at the Soundtrack Series elsewhere. And it is a lot of fun. Mike Daisy is appearing at that event next week. And I know they're very excited about that.
When that is?
It's at LPR. Yeah, the Poissonneurs. That's everything. Anyone else have something to add?
I just want to say that because we talked about this like weeks, if not months ago, that Bike Man, I think, is wrapping up soon. And I still haven't seen it. And I'm going to try to get to that this week, which is the 9/11 play that I am optimistic about, despite the fact that everyone rolls their eyes when I'm like, do you want to come see this with me?
We look forward to hearing your report on that.
As we will not be attending with you.
Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode of the Max Moo Podcast. Just a reminder that the next episode out Thursday is an interview with Kirk Lynn from the theater collective Rude Mechanicals out of Austin, Texas. You can find us all on Twitter. Max Moo is at MAXAMOO. Nicole is at Mildly Bitter. That's MILDLYBITTER. David is at It's Delevy, ITSDLEVY. And I'm at Lindsay Behrens, LINDSAYBARENZ. See you next time.